Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis, a podcast of the New Books Network. My name is Sebastian Trul, your host for today, and I am in conversation with Amber Trotter about her book Psychoanalysis as a Subversive Phenomenon, Social Change, Virtue, Ethics, and Analytic Theory, which was published by Lexington in 2019. Amber completed a bachelor's degree in sociology at Middlebury College, where her senior thesis focused on social movement theory and climate activism. She received her doctorate from the California Institute of Integral Studies, and she completed her clinical internship at Access Institute for Psychological Services, where she currently teaches. Amber is also a founding editor at Damage Magazine. For those of you who don't know the magazine, make sure to check it out. It's really fantastic. And she thinks and writes about psychoanalysis, ethics, politics, digital technology, and processes of social change. She's in private practice in San Francisco. Welcome to the program, Amber. It's really a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. The pleasure is all mine.
Great. So, Amber, I guess the first thing that came to my mind when I started to read the book is that, you know, so many parts of psychoanalysis, and I guess especially psychoanalytic clinical theory has focused on sort of downplaying the subversive potential of psychoanalysis over the last decades, right? There have been attempts to make it a psychotherapy just like any other, to sort of, I guess, to an extent, pull its teeth. But you take a very different approach to the subject, and you could say you pretty much champion this very subversive and radical potential for individual, but also for societal change that is a big part, I guess, of psychoanalysis. So what made you approach our field, or I guess our clinical field, but also our theoretical field from that angle?
It's a good question. It's a nice way of starting. You know, I've always been interested in radical social change from the time I can remember, all through adolescence and into college. I was introduced to Freud in college. We read Civilization and Its Discontents, and the book made a big impact on me. So I suppose I came to psychoanalysis from a more theoretical or sociological perspective and was interested in its radical potential long before I thought about studying to become a therapist. Read a lot of Frankfurt School stuff, and as I studied social change and sociology major in college, I found myself thinking about the way that subjective experience in all of its complex, gritty, multiplicity is too often under-theorized or neglected, and Freud's sort of elucidation of the way we internalize culture and society and then reify the norms we've internalized was something that really interested me. So that drew me to psychoanalysis in a kind of intellectual way long before I started studying psychology, and then found, you know, psychology as a profession relatively, you know, not radical, and psychoanalysis included. And so the dissertation from which this book arose sort of started from this place of trying to get clearer about what I actually think is radical, what interests me, what compels me and many other people, what kind of turns me on as this radical potential. And then why does not that potential translate into action kind of more of the time? What are the barriers to that subversiveness having more material impact?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I think the very interesting perspective that you also offer in the book is, I guess, to an extent that we haven't properly theorized that subversive potential of psychoanalysis. And that's why patients or prospective patients who are interested in that sort of change, I guess, either for themselves or culturally or politically, sort of don't have psychoanalysis on the radar anymore to a large extent. So what happened? Like how, because I mean, we could argue that there were also times when that was different, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how deep dive to do into history, but certainly in the second half of the last century, psychoanalysis at first went from perhaps being something more radical or subversive or edgy with more teeth in the meat of thinking about society and culture and the way that it can be repressive or oppressive, moved in the second half of the last century, at least in the United States, to being something more hegemonic, you know, something for the worried well, the affluent and elite. And to be an analyst, you had to be, of course, a medical doctor, and one could say it lost a bit of its subversive edge. And then, of course, things opened up and psychoanalysis stopped actually being hegemonic and has become increasingly marginalized, one could say hyper-marginalized today. So, yeah, I think you're right. Prospective patients don't often have much of any idea about psychoanalysis other than it's this kind of antiquated old version of psychology and we've moved on to the bigger, better thing of behavioral medicine. And if they do think about psychoanalysis, I don't think that it's thought of as something really radical, right? Which is unfortunate because I think it's such a wonderful tool for thinking about ourselves in ways that are unsettling, destabilizing, disruptive, radical.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you just brought up the hyper-marginalization, right? And in the book, you sort of make an attempt, we could say, to offer ways how our field could move from hyper-marginalization to optimal marginality, right? To engaging cultural and political issues still in sort of a marginal position, but engaging certain issues, I guess closer to what motivates people, right? What are people thinking about anyways? And one road you offer, I guess one road that's sort of central to your thesis is the way of ethics, of virtue ethics to be precise. And to be honest, that seems counterintuitive in the beginning, thinking together psychoanalysis and, well, psychoanalysis as an ethical project, but it unfolds very nicely in your book. But could you I don't know, maybe give the listening audience sort of a bit of an overview of why you think that, well, first of all, I guess psychoanalysis could be an ethical project, and how looking at it from that perspective might actually give us an inroad away from hypermarginalization to sort of optimal marginality.
Gosh, there's a lot in that question. I'll respond, I hope, sort of slowly and maybe draw out a few different things in what you said. I suppose I start the book wondering, well, what is subversive? What actually helps to really change in radical ways prevailing status quos at their roots, right? What allows for fundamental social change, for disrupting norms, hegemonies, right? This kind of thing. I think about that abstractly a bit. And then I think about how psychoanalysis as a both method of working with people, right? An embodied discipline, but also a kind of philosophy or tradition of inquiry into the human condition aligns and doesn't align with that previous kind of thinking in the book. So this question of what would a subversive analytic social psychology really look like? And it's of course whimsical because we're really existing psychoanalysis today is pretty far from that, but it's still a worthwhile project, I think, one that I have a lot of fun engaging with. Look, social change is very complex. It's overdetermined, and in some sense, you can only make a comment on what has been definitively subversive post hoc. You can only examine it after the fact. But in order to really change society and culture in fundamental ways, I think that you need to engage basic ethical questions in this kind of Platonic or Aristotelian tradition of ethics, which is just like, what is a life well lived? What is human flourishing? What is human suffering? How do we relieve suffering? What is a good society? How do we live life well? And I think psychoanalysis gets right in there with those questions, right? And I think part of psychoanalysis functioning subversively is getting back to those questions and articulating a clear, positive, progressive ethical vision. And I make a version of this in the book. I kind of make an attempt and articulate ethical principles like the importance of attending to subjective experience, regard for the unknown and unknowable, care, mutuality, paradox, creativity, these kinds of things, right? So just situating psychoanalysis as an ethical discipline. In some sense, you're right, psychoanalysis and ethics can seem quite opposed. Freud is famously derisive about religion and morality and certainly virtue pursued through kind of prohibition or trying to repress the bad. But I think in the, you know, Platonic Aristotelian tradition of just a discipline of character that helps us think about how we want to be in the world and kind of move towards that, not in an omnipotent controlling kind of a way, right? But through conversation and experience. Aristotle recommends friendship. Psychoanalysis aligns with some of Aristotle's idea through this relationship between the analyst and the patient. So I guess that's one thing. I think that psychoanalysis's ethical vision should be informed by clinical work. It's something unique that psychoanalysis has to offer, is that participation and witnessing of the gritty, mundane experience that patients are bringing, right? It would be a very nuanced, complex kind of vision. I think that a subversive analytic social psychology would not be reductionistic in the sense of kind of reducing psychology to structural impingements and, you know, material circumstances that we're reacting to, but neither would it be sort of reduce society to psychology, theorize that, oh, we voted for this person because of the authoritarian personality complex, for example, it would really be bringing ethics to the consulting room and to clinical work, which we could talk more about this. I think it pushes against, you know, ideas of neutrality in interesting ways, as important of a concept as I think neutrality is. But we would be thinking as therapists about how to cultivate a subjectivity sort of capable of resistance, right? So that's some of the core thinking. And then there's this idea that you mentioned of optimal marginality. I think in order to function subversively, any given person or intellectual paradigm, political movement, has to find a position of optimal marginality. If you're too ensconced in the status quo, you're not going to have the perspective or will to be truly subversive. But if you're too hyper-marginalized, you don't have a seat at the table. You're not going to change hearts and minds. Right? And I think that the contemporary left can kind of fetishize transgressiveness or the really, truly radical kind of concepts. But I think to actually function subversively, effectively, you have to find some kind of balance between dissonance and resonance, right? You have to have a conversation, a dialogue where you can, we know this as therapists, right? I mean, you and I probably can think of many examples in our own work where we're trying to situate ourselves in a way that is optimally marginal, kind of being empathic and aligned and really getting things from the inside. And what does that feel like to the person? But also keeping a different perspective. Well, let me play the devil's advocate. And how can we move this in a different direction? Or what if we thought about this from a very different way? So I think clinically we understand the concept of optimal marginality. I think in the contemporary kind of sociopolitical moment, psychoanalysis as a discipline is quite hyper-marginalized. So what would it look like to become more optimally marginalized, to have a seat at the table? I don't know. I think it feels pretty far away. So I have a lot of humility on this subject. But I think that getting outside of the analytic institutes, outside of the consulting room, participating in discourse and political struggle, cross-fertilization with other disciplines, you know, really being in more conversations, learning from other like-minded traditions, finding ways of articulating what it is that psychoanalysis has to offer that resonate, right? Uh-huh, uh-huh. That was a very long answer, but...
That's great. That's great. And no, absolutely. And I think just one aspect I'd like to draw out a little bit more is the, you know, the closeness of I guess of the analyst or of the therapist, but also of psychoanalysis as a discipline to the gritty and mundane, as you called it. I think that is really something very important that analysis brings to the table, right? This is not a top-down venture of very abstractly talking about virtues or ethics or what, you know, sort of the hopes and dreams and desires of people, but we actually follow that very closely in the consulting room, right? We're with that. That's what we work with. So I think that, you know, the concept of actual like sustainable change is born in that sort of environment, right? Because like we know how long it takes to sort of see that change come about, right? Because you have to work with the resistances and the very, you know, the nitty gritty, right? You have to work with that, and then hopefully a process develops out of that. And I think that's a very, very good model to work within the consulting room, but I guess possibly also in broader culture, right? But at that point, it feels like at this political moment, we come up against all sorts of resistances that we know from the consulting room, but I think that have sort of exploded in the public sphere as well, right? Consider splitting, for example, right? There's good and bad, and the two of them are not allowed to meet, right? We're so well used to that in the culture and in the political discourse now, that I don't know, those are some of the strongest, well, not the strongest, but some of the really hardcore resistances in the consulting room. And I just wonder how we can carve out space in the culture, in the political sphere to, I don't know, work with these like deeply entrenched resistances, because you see, like, it seems to be so difficult to talk about, I guess, especially at this point, about issues of identity, for example, right? There's so much victimization going on, and so much discourse around bad people harming victimized people, and there almost seems to be like no way to go beyond that in some instances.
It does all feel very paranoid schizoid, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that part of what psychoanalysis has to offer that is so unique is that experience in the consulting room. And look, we understand what it's like to try to help people change. And it's hard. It's hard work. There's this funny paradox that I feel very close to in my work as a therapist. That look, it's hard for people to change. People don't change. In some ways, I have to do my work with no expectation that there will be any change. And yet radical change is always possible. It's right there. It's a step away. And I couldn't do the work that I do if I didn't believe people could really change. I felt that as a therapist, as a patient. Right? And, you know, in addition to the theory, the theoretical psychoanalysis benefiting from that kind of gritty day in and day out work where the rubber hits the road, we also benefit as a theoretical discipline from the empathy required for good clinical work. You have to empathize. You have to maintain that empathic alliance. You can't push people if you don't maintain that. And I think that that is something that is on my mind so often when we come up against the present, you know, political landscape and the splitting and vitriol that one encounters there. Look, I guess one thing I would say is that I can romanticize psychoanalysis, right? It's the thing that I found that has made so much sense to me and been impactful. And I kind of own in the book, I can idealize psychoanalysis a bit and perhaps make more of its radical potential than that radical potential warrants. But I do wonder what lessons we can draw from clinical practice to the broader sociopolitical context. What provisions do we need to think critically, to challenge our basic assumptions, to kind of fall apart and consider other possibilities, right? And there's a lot to contemplate there. Empathic, supportive relationships, someone kind of being there while you fall apart, just time and space. Sometimes I think the most radical things I offer patients these days is just 50 minutes where their phone is turned off, no distractions, and they're actually forced to look at themselves. I do a lot of couples work, and it's interesting. I'll often kind of start in a light way, like, well, how are you two doing? Just how are A and B? And they'll look at each other and kind of ask out loud, how are we doing? I don't think we've asked that question since we saw you last, right? So just that time and space, for a kind of process of subjective exploration, of wondering about our lives and how we are doing, becomes a very radical act. I do trace in the book three different things that I think are particularly radical about psychoanalytic work that maybe have broader application. One is this kind of, I call it the deconstructive paradigm, where we really analyze ourselves, right? Psychoanalysis, we think about, where did that thought come from? Where did that want come from? Why? What's the developmental history? What's at stake here for me? What's the core fear? That kind of process, which I think if we take subjectivity to be radically socially conditioned, as we more or less do these days, it's an inherently sort of political act, right? The second paradigm I sketch is this antinomian paradigm, trying to get us in touch with a freedom that exists sort of beyond ourselves, beyond the social order. This is kind of the attention to unconscious processes, to wild, libidinal, bodily urges, and the kinds of freedoms that exist in those realms. And then I sketch this complexity paradigm, where I think a core part of what is radical about psychoanalysis is precisely this kind of indeterminate, overdetermined, things are always more complex than they seem. The symptom is meaningful. The Freudian slip of tongue is meaningful. Kind of questioning everything, complexifying everything, right? I think that is radical. I think I already said this, but the privacy of the consulting room feels radical. And in our hyper-surveilled contemporary society, I think that becomes very important. I don't think people are particularly willing to take risks and think about themselves in really vulnerable, humble ways if they're, you know, being watched. So I think that the consulting room exists outside of the contemporary panopticon. And, you know, again, I don't know what the translated process looks like, but I do think we need spaces and places to think in analytic terms more collectively, right?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, thanks for bringing up the three paradigms, because I think, well, what all three of them, I guess, to an extent have in common is that they're also born, obviously, in the consulting room, right, and in the clinical situation, and have been established within a certain frame, I'd say, right? I mean, there has to be a solid frame, a solid, I don't know, frequency of sessions, I guess we could talk about that, in order to even allow for complexity to emerge, for this radical deconstructive or antinomian work to, I guess, function properly without the person going to pieces, unraveling without being held, right? I mean, that's, you have to have the deconstruction, but you also have to have the solid frame to do it in. And in thinking about that, I was wondering that if we as psychoanalysts or as therapists making use of psychoanalytic ideas want to bring to fruition this subversive or radical potential of psychoanalysis, what sort of a frame do we need, right? Because that seems to be the question. How does it extend out of the consulting room through us as clinicians, and then I guess outwards again, right? What sort of frame do we need? What sort of frame does that need to be contained in? So I was just thinking about that, and also about the idea of solidarity among analysts that you bring up as sort of a prerequisite for moving, I guess, analysis, or for moving it along in a marginalized position.
I guess I'll talk about the frame and then maybe talk about solidarity. I think that over the last, I don't know how long, but let's say 20 years, as clinicians, as analytic clinicians, have been more interested in re-engaging society and extending out beyond the kind of old school elitist analytic institutes and et cetera, right? Psychoanalysis has been kind of rightly critiqued as elitist and, concentrating only on a particular kind of patient. And part of that, of course, is this, private analyst's office with, leather furniture and dark walls, and you come four times a week and lay on the couch, and people can't afford that, or that's kind of out of touch or something. And so what is the frame that is necessary has been a very open question. Something I will say that has been inspiring to me is the way that the current psychedelic therapy movement has been very clear about frame. What is the set and setting? What is the frame required to do this kind of work? It's taken very seriously. This is massive. This could potentially change things for you in such a positive way, psychedelic medicine. But it's also something to really take seriously. It could be scary. You can come unraveled. And so we're going to take the frame question very seriously. And look, I don't particularly want to say, I think it has to be once a week, or it has to be twice a week, or it has to be in person, screw this, trying to relate through a screen. I don't want to be too prescriptive about it, but I think it's a really important question. Not to pretend that you can do psychoanalysis, in a half hour session twice a month, let's just say. It's a really good and meaningful and I think timely question.
It's really interesting, if I may jump in real quick, because I was just thinking about a corresponding, I guess, development or change that I sort of perceive within the left, the left in the West, I guess, that has been so focused on, as you were saying before, on transgressivity and being countercultural for a very long time, and in recent years, I guess also with the rise of sort of a populist approach to left wing politics, you see material questions sort of reappearing that have been, I guess, marginal, which seems odd to even say that material questions have been marginal to left-wing thinking. But in some contexts of the left, that seems to be the case. And similarly, I think in psychoanalysis, this development of sort of like saying, well, you can do analysis in whatever kind of setting. It's not bound to this like very elitist, you know, 4 or 5 times a week in this sort of office kind of thing. To actually now thinking about, well, but what are the minimum, what is the minimal frame needed to sort of, you know, make the most of yeah, I guess individual disturbing complexity, right? It's very interesting how there seem to be parallel processes going on.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate the laughter, as you said, that the contemporary left seems to have lost sight of material politics, you know, material circumstances. One isn't sure whether to laugh or cry, but there's some truth there. And it's, you know, I guess if I try to think about what I think you're sort of getting at, what are the basic conditions under which radical leftist politics might flourish? What is the frame that we might need? Right? And basic needs being met might be one of those things. Like before we get to transgression, perhaps we need to think more about bread and water, so to speak. What kinds of conditions allow radical collective political action to flourish? And I went to college in Vermont, and it was a wonderful experience. I had a lovely undergraduate experience. It's a very small and relatively homogenous state. And I remember having this thought coming from California. I'm a California native. Gosh, democracy works better in Vermont. In part because it's just small and engaged in a sort of different way, where people go to town hall meetings. There's a participation in collective politics. It was quite striking for me coming from California. The town hall meetings, the potlucks, the community events, the just people feeling connected and a sense of solidarity, I suppose, which maybe can circle back to this other question you raised, but anyway, that's a sort of just anecdote from my own life. But what are the conditions under which radical leftist politics might actually take hold? What's the frame? I think it's a great question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's at least say we need a frame, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
In which to kind of think.
Well, and to an extent, that seems to be the most provocative thing about analysis these days, right? To even raise the point that you need some sort of dependability, or while you need to depend on another. And I think that's also a point you make in the book. You make it really well when you sort of put next to each other virtues of American culture, hegemonic American culture, and psychoanalytic virtues, right? And what really jumped out at me is this idea of freedom, where I think psychoanalysis is already optimally marginal towards like Western, or I guess mostly American discourse around freedom, that's considered something that's completely autonomous. You know, you can make decisions out of, you know, your own will, and it's a freedom from persecution and harassment. But analysis, I guess, complicates that picture a lot, because, you know, freedom, well, obviously we don't really know what we want in analytic terms, because our desire is unconscious, but also you need to have an other there to sort of come to terms and even develop what you might want, what you might desire, and then go after that, right? And that's, I think that is so counterintuitive to so many people these days, to actually need to depend on other people in order to develop your own desire, I guess you could say.
I suppose I would clarify for our listeners that in the book, something I do quite playfully, it's a fairly whimsical project, but following Aristotle's derivation of core ethical principles in the Nicomachean Ethics, I derive a list of psychoanalytic ethical principles, kind of foundational ethical principles of psychoanalysis as I see them, as I understand them, drawing on textual analysis, but also my own just lived experience as a clinician and a patient. And then I do the same for American, contemporary American society, focusing specifically on the ethos of neoliberalism, because I think neoliberal capitalist ethos dominates contemporary society, or kind of is something to focus on within the diversity and complexity of contemporary American society. And I do that looking at some empirical data, value polls, etc., texts on the subject, and also just sort of my lived experience. And it's very playful because psychoanalysis is so hyper-marginalized that it's not as if, you know, analytic thinking and theory is interfacing with contemporary ethical discourse in some kind of fertile dialogic way. But if it were to be able to do so, I think the ethical visions are very interesting in the context of potential subversion, right? Kind of being able to resonate, but also push back, affirm, but also critique. And there's a lot of similarity. Many of the principles are kind of shared. Many of them are quite different. And then I focus on two that I think are good illustrations of a potentially optimal marginality or optimally marginal discourse between these two visions. And one thing I focus on is the concept of individuality or individualism, I suppose. And then the other is freedom. I've been personally fascinated by the idea and lived experience of freedom and agency my whole life. It's something I've written about a lot, and spend a bit of time in the text here. And I think psychoanalytic ideas of freedom are so compelling and could be taken up in a productive, generative way, because freedom is already such a core American value, such a part of our collective spirit and discourse. But it's often American freedom. It's often a kind of negative vision of freedom, meaning a kind of freedom from obligation, responsibility, etc., and an omnipotent kind of freedom, freedom to be able to do what I want. And psychoanalysis, of course, values freedom so much, really champions freedom. Free association is the sort of signature method, but freedom is conceived differently, something much more collective and relational, a kind of freedom to be able to do things, to be able to participate in collective life, so to speak, or to be able to be creative in our own lives, something like this. And also it's a very kind of not omnipotent and almost paradoxical version of freedom. Freedom comes from a psychoanalytic perspective often through surrender, release, letting go, allowing something mysterious to unfold.
Yeah, it seems much more receptive in that way than the American model, or like what you, I guess, the neoliberal model in a sense, you could say.
Yes, I think neoliberalism has really co-opted the concept of freedom, shall we say. Much mileage has been gained by appealing to people's ideas of freedom, right? Free enterprise and the free market.
Well, that sort of brings me back to the issue we were talking about before, the issue of solidarity within psychoanalysis as a field, because I think to an extent this I guess virtue of endless competition and of sort of bringing out what the best insular group within psychoanalysis might be has really like been very destructive from the inside of psychoanalysis to the discipline itself. And you put forward this idea of solidarity within psychoanalysis, but I have to say I'm dubious about that idea, because there's so many factions and they're so vitriolic at times that, I mean, solidarity in psychoanalysis, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Sounds a bit pie in the sky to you.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the project that New Books in Psychoanalysis is involved in, right? We have so many different factions under our umbrella, and I think it works quite well. But in institutes that are so hierarchically organized also, I have no idea how that's supposed to play out, to be honest.
Yeah, I hear you. It feels a bit utopian to me too, a bit naive. I will say that something that I have theorized for a long time is that I think solidarity is really important to subversive phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it comes with the issue of marginality, right? Because you rightly raise the point that this sort of marginalization is bound to trigger so many anxieties, right? About belonging, about being part of the broader culture. And if we don't have solidarity amongst each other, like how to bear that anxiety?
Right. I think that sustaining a subversive, optimally marginal position is difficult. It's constantly sort of threatened by outside forces who are kind of out to obliterate the subversive faction altogether, so to speak, or to co-opt the subversive faction, but also threatened from within. Anxiety and infighting and all kinds of things threaten to kind of undermine subversive phenomenon from the inside. You get a lot of this kind of factionalism and divisiveness and just anxiety, right? Group life is so hard. I think a robust solidarity becomes really important. And I think that kind of solidarity, it can't be ironclad. There has to be room for difference and dynamism. It should be firm but flexible. And I think a kind of embodied, flexible, but clear ethical vision can afford a good basis for that kind of solidarity. But I think it's hard, right? And I think for psychoanalysis to have a seat at the table and function more subversively, but within contemporary cultural discourse, there would have to be a minimum solidarity. And what, Paul, you were talking, I thought of this line that I may not get right. This isn't my line, it's someone else's, but to Freud's lasting credit, he never put all of his, you know, wonderful, complicated thinking about the human condition into a single unified theory. Yes, that's the author. I don't think I'm getting the quote quite right, but it's a wonderful quote. And I think he's right. To Freud's lasting credit, you can kind of read anything you want reading Freud, like pick your Freud. And to a certain extent, I think that's wonderful and dynamic and alive. And how it's the impossible profession, right? How can you do it? How can you kind of, what is the frame and what are the principles and what is the foundation that could sustain a charitable heterodoxy? Right? What are we all invested in enough to sustain solidarity? And then within that, you can have all kinds of disagreement, But that was part of actually what was kind of fun about distilling this ethical vision, was trying to think, what do we all agree about? Right?
I think that might actually, that's what I was thinking. It might actually be like a really good exercise, even for institutes, right? To actually think collectively about what are our shared values? Like what, you know, not like on theoretical grounds, because they're so prone to infighting, right? Bickering about like psychoanalytic terms and theory, but actually like, you know, breaking it down to the level of values or virtues, as you call them, and think about, you know, what can we agree on, like fundamentally? And that could be grounds for solidarity then, right? Mm-hmm.
That's my hope. You know, that was what part of the exercise for me, was trying to really think across the parts of me that are Jungian and Freudian and Kleinian and contemporary relational psychology. And, you know, I'm someone who's, I'm eclectic, right? I'll kind of read Lacan and fall in love for a bit. And so it was fun and useful to me to kind of think about what would I not part with? What are the core things, like the unconscious, what I kind of render as an ethical principle from that is regard for the unknown and unknowable. The importance of attending to subjective experience. That was part of the hopeful book or something that I think might be useful for other thinkers to take from the project is precisely that kind of ethical vision. Like if you get rid of all of the jargon and endless debate, what is it that psychoanalysis stands for?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's why also, you know, discussions or dialogue with other disciplines becomes so important, because I guess it's just like in the therapeutic or the analytic dyad, that you need to engage with someone outside of your own discipline to see yourself clearer, or to sort of spell out what you're about, right? To find points of contact also, right? To figure out what does psychoanalysis share with, I don't know, like the parts of the contemporary left, for example, like what do these different groups stand for, and where's the shared ground, for example? I think it's very important to do that in discourse, and that sort of brings me to, I guess, already our final question. We've run for 50 minutes. Goodness, I was wondering if you could say some more about Damage magazine, the online magazine that you are founding editor of, because it seems to me that part of what you're doing with the magazine relates to what you've spelled out as a vision in the book about, you know, interdisciplinary dialogue, engaging culture and political questions with a psychoanalytic edge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to. I guess I would say, thinking about the kind of isolation of psychoanalysis, you're right that there's some kind of irony, rich irony, in this phenomenon of isolation and therefore kind of losing touch, that a fundamental psychoanalytic insight is that we need other people to see ourselves clearly. I mean, there's a limit to how well we can perceive ourselves, right? That truth is a relational kind of social process. And I actually feel encouraged on this front. I do think analytic thinkers are much more interested in dialogues with outside disciplines and society more broadly. So Damage magazine came out of this group called the Society for Psychoanalytic Inquiry that I've been part of for some time, but wasn't involved in starting. It's a diverse group of people, some clinicians and many academics. And we had a reading group. We did some summits. The reading group was just called Analytic Social Psychology. So we would read text together. The group is scattered throughout the country. So we would have these calls on Sunday to discuss analytic texts, but also sociological texts, political texts. And we would read both. And it was just really fun because people were coming from different perspectives, right? There was a good bit of cross-disciplinary dialogue. And at a certain point, I think in 2017, a group of us started talking about forming a magazine, in part, frankly, just to publish our own ideas. But it's taken off. It's grown some real readership, and we get a good number of submissions these days. And, you know, we look, what would I say succinctly here? Damage tries to look at the way that late capitalist society damages subjectivity and relationships. So there should be some psychoanalytic component to the pieces, but they're quite diverse. You know, we just got a submission I edited recently. It was about cryptocurrency, right? But some kind of more depthful perspective where we try to really look, like I said earlier, in nuanced and interesting ways at the bidirectional and just infinitely complex process by which we internalize the social order and our subjective and relational lived experience is affected by material reality, but also the way that our engagement in the world is shaped by our own subjectivity. It's kind of a weaving together of political economy, current Marxist thinking, but also socio-historical context and the formation of subjectivity. It's quite broad in that sense, but we try to stay clear to some of the original mission. And it's been fun for me to have Damage part of my life as I do clinical work. I'm a pretty full-time therapist. It's what I do. And I think back to this kind of loss of perspective, I can get so focused on individual patients that I'm not bringing in as much kind of rich thinking from the outside. And it's so stimulating and so useful for my patients, I think, to be thinking about the world that we live in really complicated, diverse ways. It helps me function well as a therapist, I hope.
Well, I guess, and also if I may add, vice versa, right? Because I think the experiences that we have in the consulting room are too important to just stay there. I mean, it also really helps possibly broader culture if we find an outlet and a platform to talk about what we experience in the consulting room and engage cultural and political issues through that lens. So I think, right, both sides profit from that sort of exchange.
Yeah, that's definitely a core belief of ours at Damage, that it's so helpful to start with that lived experience, that richly textured phenomenon, and then link to broader theories, even kind of lightly, is more useful and interesting than just staying in this realm of theory all the time. So it's been a challenge for me actually to try to write about my clinical work for Damage. You have to respect confidentiality and develop these sometimes very clunky case studies. But yeah, it's been a very rewarding experience to do some of that, to try to think about, even within my small caseload, you know, let's say I see 30 people a week, but I hear themes. I really hear themes. And when something pops, I want to write about it and think about what is being reflected here. How does this relate to other things I've been thinking about?
Well, Amber, we have to bring this to a close, unfortunately, already. We're almost at the 1 hour mark. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And I think it's very important what you're doing with the book. And I hope that the audience will pick it up and pick up cues from our conversation here. Just again, to repeat myself, the book has been Psychoanalysis as a Subversive Phenomenon, Social Change, Virtue, Ethics, and Analytic Theory. And I've been talking to Amber Trotter. Thank you so much, Amber.
Thank you, Sebastian. That was really quite fun. I appreciate the podcast and I appreciate you having me on.